got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your co-host, Cameron English.
And my name's Kevin Falta. I'm a professor that does research in plant molecular biology and genomics, but I also work in science communication and consultation. I have a passion for sharing what we learn about science.
And today we're breaking down some major developments from the world of genetics and biotechnology. And first up, the Cavendish banana is under threat from a deadly disease, and CRISPR gene editing may be our best hope for saving it from extinction. Plant-based meat startup Beyond Meat is taking on critics who say its vegan beef is quote-unquote ultra-processed. And from the world of cancer genetics, CRISPR could help accelerate DNA sequencing and then possibly develop customized cancer treatments for individual patients. And just this week, for the first time ever, scientists have used CRISPR to edit DNA inside a live patient in hopes of treating blindness. And finally, with all these advancements in genetic engineering and also in artificial intelligence, the question arises, how does the general public feel about this? Because this technology is really going to drastically shift very intimate parts of our lives. So we're going to look at a study, or a survey rather, that tried to answer that question. All right, Kevin, so without any further ado, let's dive into these stories. So when I go to the grocery store and I see bananas everywhere and they're super cheap, it's hard to imagine that we might actually lose the Cavendish. So tell us what's going on with that.
Well, it's really a kind of a sad story because bananas are so affordable and they're packaged in this nice biodegradable wrapper and they're ubiquitous, right? You see them in the convenience store in the middle of nowhere. It's an amazing crop. And, when I was a kid, I remember there was a lot more of a theme of slipping on banana peels on TV and stuff. It was part of my childhood and hopefully something that my children's children will enjoy as well. You know, it's always funny. But the banana of commerce, this Cavendish banana, that's what they call the one that we eat every day, this seedless thing that we eat. This is threatened by Fusarium tropical race 4. And it's a disastrous fungus that when it hits, it's like a spray plane just laid out the entire plantation of bananas. So it's a really, really bad disease.
Now, fill in the gaps for me. So bananas are sterile, I believe. And so they can only be produced by cloning. Is that correct? And so that presents some difficult breeding conditions. So elaborate on that, if you would.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. So bananas actually have three sets of chromosomes, at least the ones we eat. So the regular banana, the Cavendish banana, got, instead of like us where we get one set of chromosomes from mom, one set from dad, here bananas got two from mom, one from dad, or vice versa if you're a plantain. Now and the idea is that when you have this extra set of chromosomes, you don't make seeds, you're infertile. And so this is why bananas don't make the seeds and why we have to make every new banana plant of that same variety from a clone. And so every single banana plant that you see that's a Cavendish banana, they all came from one foundational plant, now over millions of acres of cloned trees. So that's really the basis of the problem.
So tell us about this story. I believe it was in the Telegraph, and they're talking about using CRISPR gene editing to potentially immunize the banana against this particular disease. I believe it's called TR4. So tell us about the story, and then tell us a little bit about how we can use CRISPR to potentially avoid this disease.
Yeah, this is super cool. Now, the Fusarium tropical race 4, TR4, is an isolate of the pathogen Fusarium, which kills bananas like crazy. It's the one that killed Big Mike, Gros Michel, was tropical race 1. This is tropical race 4. And what's so cool about this is that all of tropical race 4 is a clone of one single fungal spore, one single fungal isolate way back when. So here we have a clone killing a clone. I mean, think about how cool that is, you know, I mean, devastatingly cool. I mean, not cool if you're a banana.
Right.
But the deal is, This was first seen in 1989 in Malaysia, and it went across Indonesia, India, Australia, the Middle East. Now it finally has reached South America. And that's where the majority of North America's and most of Europe's bananas come from. It is from Colombia, Ecuador, up through Panama and Costa Rica, Honduras. That whole area is a tremendous banana producer. And so now you have this clone ready to infect all of this. It's resistant to most pesticide applications, and it threatens the banana crop. So the idea now was, could you somehow use molecular biology and cool technology to save it? And it was demonstrated that by using a resistance gene from something called Musa acuminata, this thing, when you use this gene from this other kind of banana that makes lousy fruit and lots of seeds, it never got the disease. So you could take the gene that would give it resistance, called RCA2 or RGA2, and put that into the Cavendish banana and make it completely resistant. But because it's now a GMO product, that is a non-starter, because you couldn't be able to market this in Europe. All the other issues with having a highly regulated plant, even though it can't make seeds, you know, or cross-pollinate, you know, so some of those concerns are moot. So the other way to do this is potentially to use gene editing and to use this CRISPR-Cas9 process. So a company called Tropic Biosciences in Norwich, UK, they're trying to solve problems in banana. And what they're doing is editing some genes to make them maybe ripen a little slower. And that's pretty cool, because one bad banana spoils the whole bunch. If you get a few bananas that start the process of ripening, they produce ethylene gas, which is a hormone, which then triggers all of them to go. And there's a substantial part of every banana shipment that goes bad because of a rogue banana that ripened too early. So you have that. The other side of this is that I always thought it would be cool to have seven bananas in a bundle, where one was really green, one was kind of brown and freckly, and all the stages in between. And maybe having slower ripening would give us this opportunity for, like, you know, a banana day concept. So there's all kinds of cool things here. So how do you do this with respect to disease? So what the plan is you use gene editing to destroy susceptibility genes. So here's how it works. When you look at plants and their pathogens, it's kind of an arms race. Yet there is a funny relationship in this arms race, that the plant and pathogen frequently shake hands biochemically. And the pathogen recognizes the host recognizes pathogen motifs, and these two know each other. So what if you edited or deleted or inactivated the features that the pathogen recognizes? So in other words, it's kind of like taking a lock and key, right, where you got a key and a lock that fit together, and jamming the lock full of crazy glue or something. Or what if you just throw away the lock altogether? Now the key has nowhere to go. And that's what Tropic Biosciences is trying to do. So it's a really interesting strategy.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. So how close would you say this is to being developed? Is this just kind of a proof of concept study? I know with some of the other research with like with the GMO or the transgenesis approach that you described, I believe that's pretty far along, and technically they know how to do it, but it's more an issue of marketing and, you know, politics. Is that correct?
Oh, that's exactly right. It was James Dale and his group at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. They did this other test with the transgenic banana years ago. It works. It's just a question of regulatory that really hinders it. This other approach may be able to get around the regulatory constraints because it's a gene edited, not a gene added type of situation. And so that's kind of the hope. Actually, one of my former postdocs works at Tropic Biosciences in Norwich, and she just loves it there. She says they're doing great stuff. And it's really interesting to think that the biggest breakthroughs in bananas might come out of England.
Right. Foggy old London town. Okay. So we've probably got, I don't know, maybe several or maybe quite a few years before we actually see a CRISPR edited banana on a grocery store shelf because the process is very involved. Is that the case?
Well, yes and no. Actually, once you're able to move through the tissue culture process, meaning turning that one that has the edit you want into billions of banana plants or millions of banana plants, that's really where your biggest bottleneck is. But my guess is that the fundamental science of making a plant which is edits in the right genes is probably not that difficult and not that far off. So once again, gene editing looks like it's going to bring some great dividends to ensure that we still have great food choices and a good one that can contribute to human health.
All right. Very exciting. Well, we'll cross our fingers and hope that we get to eat crisp breaded bananas really soon. So let's move on to this story in Health Europa about using CRISPR to sequence DNA and then possibly develop better treatments for cancer. So tell us about this story, because this, I think, is probably the most technical of all the stories we're looking at.
It is a little bit, and really it based on the idea of how does modern DNA sequencing work. So if you think about the letters in the DNA code, you know, the alternating A, G, C, and T, A, G, C, T, T, G, C, 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 all of that for 3.6 billion bases, that's the human genome. If you wanted to sequence an organism, the way we do it today is what's called short read sequencing. And let's just take the alphabet, for example. If I gave you A, B, C, D, E, L, M, N, O, P, T, U, V, W, X, E, F, G, C, D, E, and I just gave you these little chunks and I gave you jillions of them, you could eventually align them with each other and get the whole alphabet from beginning to end by looking at the little pieces stacked up on each other, because there'd be overlaps between these tiny fragments. That's exactly how we sequence genomes in a modern arena. And so the idea here, and this came from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, is that how do you study cancer in a high-resolution way? Because you could sequence everybody's DNA in its entirety, or actually you could pick out a certain number of genes that you know the sequence to and use the CRISPR-Cas9 tool, which is an enzyme, Cas9, that you give a little piece of information to in the form of a little piece of RNA that finds its DNA complement. So it allows you to target the genes associated with cancer in their interest. And then that Cas9, that enzyme, makes that cut in that gene and then leaves a little end that now you can add an adapter to. So you can add a piece to it and now be able to sequence from that basis, that adapter, as an anchor. So in other words, you're now able to add an anchor or some sort of a beacon, for lack of a better term, to the pieces that you want to highlight in your sequencing. So instead of sequencing the whole genome, 3.6 billion bases, you're only sequencing the ones that they find relevant to cancer. And in many cancers, we understand quite a bit about genes that have roles in the development of cancer. So that's the foundation of this approach.
Yeah, this is just crazy as I was reading through this. Okay, so I believe what they did is they identified a particular gene that's involved in breast cancer, and it's called KRT19. And I think they said they detected a lower amount of DNA methylation, and that enabled them to identify it, and then that may lead to some treatment. So for people who don't know what that is, what is DNA methylation?
Well, DNA methylation. So methylation is kind of a decoration that DNA gets inside the cell. And it's a way in which DNA gets a little methyl group, a CH3, added to it to certain bases with an enzyme called a methylase that adds that that little signature, little ornament onto the DNA. And it changes the way that DNA is packaged and the way that different enzymes or other elements of the cell integrate with DNA and regulate its expression. So it's a way of turning off genes, turning on genes, repackaging genes, lots of things that it does. So methylation in some cases does have a role in the presentation of specific genes that are associated with cancers.
Okay, so now that they've identified that, I guess the idea is they can target this specific gene and maybe others that are involved in the development of cancer or the spread of cancer. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, really what this is a case of, if you want to find a needle in the haystack, you first have to find the haystack. And what this allows doctors to do with very high resolution is to look at a large number of potential genes involved in a given cancer and assess if their variants are those that they understand, meaning certain variants of genes are associated with specific cancers and could affect the way that it's treated, could be affecting therapies and help them understand the progression of a specific cancer. So that's really all this is right now, is how do we get a signature of a specific kind of cancer so that you can hone the best treatment for it. So that's really what this technology is and why it's so important.
Interesting. And I guess why I think this is cool is I once heard an oncologist describe previous cancer treatments as I don't know if I can say it on the podcast, but basically you throw a bunch of chemicals at the wall and you see what sticks, and then whichever sticks, that's the one that you treat the cancer with. So in essence, this is allowing us to fine tune the treatments and get closer to making medicines really that are highly specific and that work for individual people. And I think that's just really cool.
Exactly. I mean, now that we're looking at things like antibodies that can work against specific agents which are presented on cancer cells, CAR T cell therapy, which is genetically engineered cancer cells, genetically engineered immune cells that specifically identify cancer cells and destroy them. There's a lot of really cool stuff happening right now in cancer biology, and it can't go fast enough, you know, in my opinion. And this is just a way of really identifying the signatures of specific cancers faster to better hone therapies. And it just is a way of combining sequencing with the gene editing machinery. So that's all this is.
Yeah, very exciting. Sounds like a big step forward, and we can never take too many, it seems. There's always more to learn and better ways to treat diseases. So let's move on to the world of food and agriculture and talk a little bit about plant-based meat. So this is a story from Elaine Watson at Food Navigator. And as I'm sure some people have heard that you have these plant-based burgers, they're at Burger King, they're at where else? White Castle. I think McDonald's is working on one, but you have dozens of fast food chains starting to serve quote unquote meat that's made from plants. And, from what I understand, the meat industry is not very thrilled about this, Kevin. They must see this as a threat because they're coming out guns blazing, taking on companies like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, which makes the Impossible Whopper. And so these companies have really had to go on the defense and say, no, our products are safe, they're healthy. We're being attacked from both ends, from the anti-GMO side, but then you're also getting attacked by the meat industry, who doesn't want the competition. And so in this article, Beyond Meat said that not only are they going to defend their products, but they're going to go on the offensive and they're going to say, hey, not only are these safe, but these might even be a better choice than certain meat products. So what's your take on this whole situation? Then we can kind of dive into some specifics.
Well, for me, it's a really interesting communications question, because for years you had Boca Burgers, Garden Burgers, all the, you know, slate of, you know, bean patty alternatives, and nobody got too bent out of shape about those. You know, they kind of just were always there on the menu and nobody really cared. But I think it was that Beyond Meat and the Impossible Burger, Impossible Meats, they have really started to hone in on exactly what makes meat meat and develop ways to really recreate an authentic facsimile. Now, Beyond is the topic of this particular article. They lost $12 million in 2018, and then last year just crushed it. I mean, huge investment, huge market cap now, and it really seems like the writing's on the wall that this stuff is here to stay. And as you mentioned, the meat industry has all been out of shape, and you know, I would kind of, if I was advising them, I'd say, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. You know, we'll lean into it.
Yeah. Yeah, but maybe buy into it or start your own and then be your own competition.
Well, the idea would be maybe that you know, there, and I mentioned this in an article I wrote on Ag Daily, is they're not making ribeyes. You know, they're making hot dogs and hamburgers. You know, it's the stuff that the meat industry is kind of, you know, always considered their low-end stuff anyway. So, you know, maybe just kind of, you know, rethink the idea of looking like you're in a position of weakness by worrying about, you know, this really what is a tiny market share of plant-based meats. You know, that's kind of what I thought, but.
Well, let me just play devil's advocate just for a second in the, you know, for the sake of fairness here. So I think the group that really amplified this issue was this group called the Center for Consumer Freedom, and they are funded by the food industry, and they fight against soda taxes and regulations on food. But the meat industry has really invested in them to take on this fight against plant-based meat. And what they're saying is, these plant-based meat companies aren't being quite upfront about what their products are. They're saying these aren't ground up plants that you're eating. I mean, these are highly processed patties and they have plant ingredients in them, but they're not some wonder food. So what do you think of that criticism? Is there anything to it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, because the Center of Consumer Freedom, first when they tell you consumer freedom right in the name, I always go, what's going on here? You know, it sounds too good to be true. But this is a guy named Richard Berman, and he has set up nonprofits throughout his career to promote certain interests in the industry. Like he set up NGOs on behalf of the tobacco industry to fight smoking bans and that kind of thing in restaurants. So this is where it's been. But, you know, the Beyond Meat products, and I've had this on my podcast too. I talked to Chana Davis, who does Fueled by Science. She, you know, said, you know, these aren't designed to be necessarily healthy. They're designed to be imitations and use whatever technology it takes to get you there. And I think that Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger, they never really wanted an adversarial relationship with meat producers. Now, the idea was create this product and see where it goes. But now they're being slammed as, like, you know, ultra processed, you know, like a Slim Jim isn't, you know. the meat industry probably likes those. Just talk about how good your product is. And I'm a fan of the meat industry. You know, I would like to see them maybe take a little more of a high road on this entire process. And this is where Beyond Meat and Impossible, especially in this case, Beyond, they're saying they're going to start pushing back a little bit the other direction.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Maybe the fairest way to look at it is to say you have two very, well, one very powerful industry and a growing industry, and they're both battling for market share. So I don't think anybody is, you know, looking out for the best interest of the consumer. And this isn't about, you know, truth and labeling or any of that. I think this is just two sides trying to protect their interests. And there's nothing wrong with that, but the key is just to make sure that we're reporting the facts and we're not being deceptive so people understand what their options really are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, there's nobody who said that the Beyond and Impossible Burger were health conscious alternatives. You know, they are roughly equivalent in most respects to saturated fat and other aspects, because you have to be if you're going to mimic it effectively. They're higher in sodium in some cases, lower in other stuff here and there, but it's a give and take. It gives consumers more choices. Some people don't like eating animals. I didn't for 16 years. And I get that, you know, I totally understand, but at the same time, it's coming up with more options, which we all should celebrate, because there may be a time when it becomes extremely difficult to continue to raise animals at the rate we do. Or, you know, feeding grain to animals that we could be feeding to people, that kind of feeling. You know, nothing against the meat industry, but it's good for us to have good technology to give us alternatives if we decide to go that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Center for Consumer Freedom, I imagine, would say that they are pro-free market and get the government out of my food. So maybe they should just do that and just let people decide what they're going to eat. And then whoever wins, wins. Or, you know, if they're both options, and that's great too, you know.
No, that's exactly it. The Center for Consumer Freedom, that's their whole website, is, you know, why is the government telling you what's good for you? And so it really is just another good option on the table. Take it or leave it. But it's a step in the right direction towards giving ultimately more people more choice.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's get on to something a little less adversarial, and let's talk about using CRISPR gene editing again, but this time we're actually using it to edit the DNA of live patients without first taking out the genes that you want to edit. So tell us about this. And this is potentially a treatment for blindness. So this is really cool.
Oh, this one just gives me chills. I love this story because it's an extension of some of the things that have been being done for a while now in the treatment of specific kinds of blindness. And you know, on my podcast over on Talking Biotech, we've talked about gene editing in leukemia and rare blood disorders like sickle cell disease, beta thalassemia. And gene editing has been used in a test tube, and then patients have been treated with the cells that have been gene edited. This technology is the first time the editing is happening in the patient. So the editing is happening inside the eye. And how cool is that?
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. Okay, so if I understand this right, and this is a story from NPR by Rob Stein, which we will link to at geneticliteracyproject.org, but I actually believe they are injecting billions of copies of a virus with the instructions to produce the CRISPR-Cas9 tool right into people's eyeballs. And then from there, it actually goes in and cuts out a mutation in the relevant gene that causes this condition, which is called Leber congenital amaurosis, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So do the geneticist thing and tell us the gritty details.
Okay, so let's talk about Leber congenital amaurosis. This is a visual impairment that begins in infancy, and it usually is relatively stable and then worsens with time. And it manifests as like a sensitivity to light, excessive nystagmus, so the eye is real twitchy, extreme farsightedness, pupils don't react normally to light, and eventually the cornea becomes rather cone-shaped and thin and keratinized. And so it doesn't really work very well. And then you start to see other behaviors in people who suffer from this, something called Franchetti's oculodigital sign. And this is where people are poking or pressing on their eyes and maybe, you know, always rubbing it, like pushing. And they suspect that this may be the way that the keratinization of the eye occurs. And this leads to eventual blindness. The thing is that this Leber congenital blindness is really a hodgepodge of 14 different genes that can be affected. And so there's a bunch of them. One of them is called RPE65. And not to go too far off track here, but we talked about beta carotene and supplementation of crops last week about putting in more vitamin A, right? Remember that one?
I do. Golden rice.
Yeah, so this is if beta carotene is this long symmetrical molecule that's cleaved in half, and then that makes two vitamin A, provitamin A's. This is where RPE65 is the enzyme that cuts the beta carotene in half. It's a 15 prime dioxygenase, we call it. It cuts that in half, and then those two little parts of the provitamin A are integrated for vision as a little antenna that captures the photon of light. So RPE65 was injected into the eye in a correct copy of RPE65, was injected into the eyes of patients that did not have the correct copy inside an adenovirus, and this would the virus would infect the retina and insert the correct copy of the gene, and it works. And people don't get their full blindness back, but they can at least be sensitive to, or their full vision back. People can't get their full vision back, but they can at least see light and figures and shadows, and it was a big step forward. Now, in this case, they're targeting a different gene called CEP290, and CEP290 defects are responsible for something like 21% or 25% of blindness. And this is a gene that is still kind of a mystery, but it's a huge gene, like a just massive gene. So you can't just package it in a virus and inject it back in the eye. So this one needs a different strategy. The role of this gene is to produce cilia. So it has a role in ciliogenesis, which is a great clown name, ciliogenesis. cilia are these little projections on cells, like for olfactory cells, like smell sensors and photosensory cells. They increase the surface area so that the chemistry of phototransduction can happen really efficiently and really fast, which is what it does. And something like 10% of ocular cilia, retinal cilia, are turned over every single day. So you're always making new ones. And this is where CEP290 has a role. And there's like 35 different mutations in CEP290 that have been described in Leber congenital amaurosis. So you can't just correct it with a, you know, add a correct copy. You have to fix an individual mutation. So in this one, there's a, in this particular case with this guy, there's a mutation which causes a problem in mRNA splicing. So you get the DNA blueprint, it's got a mistake in it. When you transcribe that to make the mRNA intermediate, it doesn't process correctly. And so this way you don't produce the correct functional protein ultimately, and it results in blindness from being able to create these cilia. And so you can use gene editing to go into somebody's eyes, go into the DNA blueprint, and erase the mistake. And if you erase that mistake, then the theory is the DNA, then the RNA will be processed correctly and will make the correct protein. So I hope that's clear, but that's the idea behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm dumbfounded by that. And we'll put some links so people can investigate this a little further. But I think we have to stress that this is very preliminary. I think they've only done it so far in one patient. I think they're going to try to do it in 15 or 20. But they started with one of the oldest patients, and they gave him the smallest possible dose of this virus, just as a proof of concept, just to see if they could do it safely. And then I think in a few weeks' time, they'll actually be able to tell if his eyesight is going to improve or is gradually improving.
Yeah, and they only did one eye.
That's right. Yeah, they're doing it only in one eye. I think this is another precaution. So they don't want people's vision to get worse in both eyes if this doesn't work. So this is really fascinating. I used to get freaked out by the idea of LASIK surgery to improve eyes, and now we're, you know, injecting DNA. So this is fascinating stuff. So again, we'll just have to wait and see what happens with this guy.
Yeah, and we'll revisit this in the next couple of weeks, because this is a really important story for a couple different reasons. Not only is it, you know, the novelty of actually doing the, you know, in the human body gene edits, but think about other ways that this could manifest in the human body. There's diseases like Huntington's disease, different muscular dystrophy, all these different diseases that we always thought would be incurable, that maybe there's ways to get in and make those edits. And I guess the kind of the caveat is that eyes are pretty easy, because you can, you know, they're accessible. You can poke, you know, a needle right into it if you're up for that. And it's also a permanent fix. You're actually changing the genetic blueprint. You know, that's what's so cool about this. You're correcting the mistake in the cells where the mistake matters. And that's why this is so powerful.
Yeah, really cool. Now, some of those other diseases, I think several of them are single gene mutation disorders, which means that they're somewhat easier to fix. Is that right? If you just have to go in and make one or a handful of edits, it's easier than some of these conditions that are polygenic. Is that correct?
Well, sure, that's true. And a lot of these just that are, as we say, autosomal recessives, where you just have, you know, some sort of defective gene that that you can make, especially like in this case, the edit was not in what we call the coding sequence of the gene. It wasn't in the part of the DNA that encodes the sequence that eventually gives the instructions for the protein. It was in a processing part. So in other words, we aren't changing the sequence at all, which would be a problem. You're changing the way, you're removing the defect that causes a problem in processing. And so this way, it's a little different than in other cases where you'd have to make an actual change in the gene. And but nonetheless, there's probably dozens and dozens of diseases that will benefit from examples like this.
Very cool. And now for people who may not know, we can move on after this, but is it still possible that that say this person or some person, if they have this defect, they could pass it on to their children? Is that correct or no?
Oh, that's a cool point. That's a really cool point. Yeah, absolutely. They would pass it on because the virus is being injected into the eye to affect those cells in the retina, and their DNA everywhere else in their body is still being passed along, and they would be able to pass on this defect to a child. The good news is that the child would know that this defect is potentially there. They could probably mask the defect by finding a suitable mate that didn't have that particular problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, a partner could be screened that would not have this issue. And then the children could be screened and treated early.
Wow. That's incredible. By the way, we'll have to talk about embryo selection sometime, because that stuff is both fascinating and, frankly, in my opinion, a little bit scary too. But that's for another day. So.
and scary in another day. But, you know, just as one other quick aside is so many cool stories about cancer and understanding how cancers work came from the blind, because they used to put blind men and blind women in special schools, in blind schools. And so people would meet in the blind school, and then their children would oftentimes have more penetrating, stronger diseases that were associated with the blindness. So the big example is retinoblastoma, where if you only have one copy of the defective gene, you have a mild form of the disease. But if you have two copies, it's a very dangerous, deadly type of cancer. And what they were finding was that the high prevalence of this a very powerful cancer happening in the offspring of two blind parents. And this led us to discover one of the most important tumor suppressor genes that's out there. So really interesting science that's associated with the blind. And here they are maybe making huge contributions again. Because the eye has this availability to be able to access the retina to make these changes.
Yeah, and one final thing I just thought of this since you mentioned retinoblastoma, but my younger brother had that as a child, and so just in 1992, the only thing they could do was just cut out his eye, and so he only has one eye, and so you know he's perfectly functional, but it's very very debilitating to have to live that way, and so here we are now, what 28, 30 years later. And we are, you know, at a position where we might very well be able to treat that with genetic engineering or gene editing. So I'm just very exciting.
Well, and also be able to give him good counseling with respect to his partners and to make sure they're screening them for specific mutations in the RB gene, you know, and science continues to do good things.
Yeah, very cool. So let's move on to our final story. And I think all of these that we're talking about build up to this one issue. So, let's talk a little bit about how the public feels about this. And this is a story by Paul Ratner in Big Think. And he's talking about a recent survey that was done about how the public feels about genetic engineering and also about artificial intelligence, because sometimes these are paired together and then other times they're used separately, but they're having profound effects on very personal aspects of our lives, whether it's medicine or the food we eat. And so I think there's potential for people to be really freaked out by this stuff. So tell us a little bit about this article, Kevin. What jumped out to you?
Well, I'll give you the punchline up front. It's that people seem to fear the cutting edge, mm-hmm. and that things behind the cutting edge are not as much of a concern. So genetic engineering, you know, that's so 2000, you know, now they're freaked out about robots. So, you know, it's a little different angle. So they asked some questions. The first question was, if editing DNA of babies to alleviate diseases was done, is that a good or bad idea? And so what do you think?
Well, I have to be honest, I think I kind of lined up with the majority on this. So I believe they said 60% of people were fine with that, with using genetic engineering to prevent diseases in children. And only 38% said it was a step too far. And so I think I'm perfectly fine with that. As I just said, you know, I have a history in my family of people suffering from really serious diseases. So if you can prevent those, then that's excellent. And although I will say I get a little less comfortable when we start talking about implanting chips into people's brains, at whatever the benefit is. So they're talking about improving concentration, improving information processing. I think those are really cool, but I'm not going to be one of those early adopters. I'm going to let some rich guy in the Bahamas somewhere, get the first one, and then let's see how it works. And then in 10 years, I'll buy one off Amazon.
Well, maybe that's how you get to be a rich guy in the Bahamas. You know, you could be the guy who gets the chip, and then, you know, I'm a huge fan of this stuff. And if you could look at the genetics of two parents and identify a problem that might happen, correct it in the embryo. Wow, that's amazing. I think we should be doing it. I kind of think we have a responsibility to do it. And that's kind of my take, but I'm a weirdo. The second one was, if animals could be engineered to make human organs for transplantation, is that good? Is that appropriate use or taking technology too far? So how do you feel on that one?
That one really doesn't bother me. And we already do that right now, right? I mean, we use animals in testing, whether it's pharmaceuticals or chemicals. And then we already do some, I don't know, are we actually growing human organs in animals yet? Or is that still in the developmental phase?
That's still a little bit off, but the idea is making these xenografts. So pigs especially, which have very similar organs and immune systems in some way, coming up with ways to kind of clear the immunological or the antigenic markers from cells so that you could basically grow a human heart or grow an appropriate heart in a pig that could be used in a human. And, you know, people do have funny feelings about these kinds of things. You know, frankly, I'd like a pigtail, or, you know, glue that on, you know, that's kind of cool. But seriously, you could imagine, and this is the part that bothers me, how many people every day die in a hospital on a waiting list. And again, I feel it's a responsibility to use the resources we have at our disposal to be able to, help the human condition. And so to me, I'm with the 57% that say this is spot on. 41% say it takes things too far. So still a very significant portion of people are uncomfortable with it. I wonder if they would be uncomfortable with it if they were the one in the hospital bed watching the sand run through the hourglass and praying for a motorcycle wreck. You know, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And that's an important point you bring up, which is that there are trade-offs in life, you know, and so it's very easy to sit, you know, in front of your computer and say, well, you know, it's really not time for that technology. It's very, you know, makes me uncomfortable. And I feel like I'm parroting myself right now. But you know, there are real issues that we could address with this. And maybe one way to look at it is this is the logical progression. Now, we've moved beyond what I'm about to say, but we used to get insulin from pigs, right? We used to take insulin out of slaughtered pig pancreases. And so we don't do that anymore, thanks to genetic engineering. I don't think, at least, because it doesn't work as well. But the point is that we already, you know, we breed animals and we take from animals to make our lives better. So maybe this is just the 2.0 version of that.
No, that's exactly right. It really is. We used to do it from pig pancreases and now do it in microbes. And, you know, in the future, we're going to do it a little bit differently. And people have always resisted the cutting edge. That's all.
Yeah. And what stuck out to me is this is from the survey, but the big issue seems to be, quote, the loss of human control, especially if such developments would be at odds with personal, religious, or ethical values. So maybe this provides another example of just involving the public and making sure people understand at least a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes. That way you don't get another GMO controversy the way you did in the late 1990s when we started doing this on the farm.
No, that's very true. And this really was amplified in the survey when they started talking about like automation and robotics. And this is really kind of interesting that there are many who feel the majority of jobs in this country and around the world will be lost to robots and automation in the next 10 to 30 years. So it's not just building cars and assembling things, but what they call knowledge work jobs being taken over by software. So things like analysis of data, decisions, letting machines make those decisions from the data rather than a person, because there's no biases. The machine might make a better decision because it's not being steered by emotion. You know, there's great movies about this kind of nightmare too, but you know, so there's also going to be jobs that will increase. And so jobs that humans are needed that involve empathy. So I guess like kind of touchy feely jobs like counseling, mental agility, things where people benefit from the human bias. You know, how do you feel? You know, that kind of thing. So whereas we're going to be replaced for our mechanical functions, we will now find new places to explore in improving the humanness of the human condition because we got machines doing the lousy work.
Yeah. And one other thing, you know, not to, you know, this is an optimistic point, which is, it's good to be optimistic. Don't get me wrong, but people really think about the new opportunities this might create. So maybe a whole nother field of work might open up for people that we just don't know about yet. Or maybe you have to work 12 hours a week instead of 40 or 50 in order to, you know, make enough money to take care of yourself. We just don't know. And I think that's what scares people. It's just, you know, am I going to have a job? You know, what's my purpose in life? You know, that stuff is all, those are really big philosophical questions. Obviously we can't answer those, but there's as much opportunity as there is risk, I would say.
Yeah. But people have always been, you know, they've always pushed, there's two realities. You always push back against technology as it happens. That's always been common. And at the same time, people have always been extremely comfortable with it once it's here. You know, once it's around for a little bit, you know, people were against in vitro fertilization. They were against artificial hearts. They were against all kinds of big breakthroughs in society. And if you want to watch a funny one, watch Future Shock, the movie Future Shock on YouTube. It was Orson Welles narrates it. It's pretty, pretty wild. But anyway, look at like, you know, you go to the bank teller. And I go there and give a stack of singles and, you know, she from my night job, you know, a stack of singles, yeah, get them out of my garter belt. She shoves them through a machine that counts them almost instantly and flawlessly. And then you look at like agriculture, you know, being able to plant on a massive scale, it's like a John Deere, you know, DB120 can do 100 acres in an hour. You know, with a 48 row planter. I mean, like 150 to 100 acres per hour that used to probably take somebody and their entire family an entire season. So, you know, we accept technology when it's there. It's just this concept of a science hesitancy or technology hesitancy. As you mentioned, it's related to loss of human control. And
yeah.
And there are places where, you know, even today, I'm driving down the road last week and there's a guy with that slow sign, you know, on the side of the road. And would you trust a machine to just put the slow thing up there? Because if it went out or malfunctioned, you'd have head-on collisions, you know, that kind of thing. Even though the guy like gave me a really dirty look as I went by and I'm thinking we could replace you with a bucket of sand, you know, and it, but but anyway, there are people in those positions and technologies that we still want a human being connected to. And it's really interesting and it says a lot about us and will we trust and how do we build trust in the new technologies that are going to come at us faster and faster?
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. You know, one thing I wonder about is, are we going to continue to embrace technology and biomedicine and then still be afraid of genetically engineered crops? You know, are we going to be walking around with like bionic arms and artificial brains? And then we're going to be like, you know, I want to know what's in my food. You know, it's just because it's all, I mean, fundamentally, it's all the same technology, you know, to simplify it, right? We're just editing DNA and so on and so forth. So I do wonder about that. Is public opinion going to evolve simultaneously on all of these? Or are we going to accept some more than others? I suspect that's going to be the case to a certain extent.
Well, why is there a dichotomy there? And that's really the interesting thing I've been thinking about. And if you think about ideas like medicine and human health and those things, it's really appealing to the executive function. You know, this is stuff that we can sit and stew on and really cogitate over using our cerebral cortex and integrating facts and information. And we're pretty comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about food, you're talking to the reptile brain. mm-hmm. and, you know, the first rung on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And it's that input that really gives us, that really can adjust with emotion and fear. And so it really comes from two different places in the brain, one of hope versus one of fear. And I think that's where people who play into it on both sides, you know, whether they're trying to sell you medicine or a sham treatment, or make you afraid of a food product so you buy something else, that's the manipulation we're under, and that'll dictate how well it's accepted in the future.
Right, because organic gummy bears are better for you than conventional gummy bears. Oh my goodness. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for us this week on Science, Facts, and Fallacies. Thank you guys so much for joining us, as always. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Spotify. And as always, you can check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.